This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
It is time, everybody, our weekly visit with our NHL insider, John Morosi. It's presented by Stanford's Restaurant, and he is here with us, as he is every week, to talk some hockey, maybe a little Major League Baseball as well. But, John, how are you?
Bob and Dave, good evening. I cannot wait. I wish I could be there in person, but the event that's going to happen on Saturday, Climate Pledge Arena, it's the one we've been talking about for years, really. So I just cannot wait to hear all the reviews of what's going to happen there Saturday night.
Well, Dave and I can give you a review because he and I just went to the Foo Fighters concert the other night there.
How was it?
It was, the building is amazing. The building is absolutely awesome. Amazing. The show was fantastic. It was, you know, traffic's going to be an issue. But
Take the light rail. So this is the time to do the plug here. Take the light rail. Take the monorail. Fit with the climate pledge of the idea, the concept of the building, and we can all do our part, right?
It's not a bad idea. The one thing, though, John, is that if I were to have had a parking pass hanging from my rearview mirror and paper tickets in my pocket, and I know that's not in keeping with Climate Pledge Arena, I would have had a more pleasant experience. The technology eludes me, and it wasn't just me, right, Bob?
No, it was not his fault. It was, you know, you're dealing with cell signals that are working well in one spot, not so well in the other, and the tickets are there, and you got to be able to download. It's a process. But it's not as easy as the days of just buying a ticket and handing it over, and here you go.
But John Paul, you've been to a lot of different places, right? And one of the things that always stands out to me is the people. And that's the thing, that like the people taking your ticket, the valet, the parking attendant, I mean, all of that stuff, that was like top notch. So
I love that.
Anything stand out for you as your travels, in whether it's the NHL, MLB, any favorites in that regard where you just feel like you're just welcomed home, you know, as far as the people that work there and the atmosphere?
That's a great question. I've been to a lot of some buildings that I would consider my favorites. Obviously, Joe Louis is very special for me in Detroit. Of course, is no longer there. Tiger Stadium in Detroit, when you get a chance to see what that bright infield looked like against the dark the dark backdrop of as you walk in the ramps. But I always love, and one of the things I love about what the concept of Climate Pledge Arena is that when you're inside it, and you guys can speak to this and better than I can. But I love that when you're in that building, everything I've heard about it is you're going to know that you're in Seattle. And sometimes with arenas, because they're enclosed, you don't always get that feel of being in a very specific place. It's harder. When you think about going to a game at Oracle Park in San Francisco, and you look out in front of you, you know you're in San Francisco. And when you're at the Bell Center in Montreal, which is probably my favorite hockey venue that's currently in the National Hockey League and probably one of my favorite sports venues anywhere in the world, you love it because you're hearing French. You're seeing the banners up in the rafters, the history of the Montreal Canadiens, and everything about the people you see in the press gondola that are greeting you all in French first, and then you try whatever best you can to speak French with them. I mean, those parts, those notes of being at an NHL game in Montreal, and that's part of it. I love that Seattle has made this venue a part of the city's identity. It's been a blend of the old and the 44 million pound roof with the new and what the Climate Pledge is and the ability to make it be carbon neutral going forward. I think that, to me, when I have a chance to visit places that are truly representative of the cities that they are a part of and the cities that they embody, I love that this arena is going to do that. I love that it's opening up with Foo Fighters. Of course, the thread part of Seattle's history and Seattle's rock and roll history and music history. So I think, to me, places that give you a real sense of who the people are and that welcoming in, those are always my favorite buildings and my favorite stadiums and favorite ballparks. And I can tell already that Seattle is doing that with Climate Pledge Arena.
Yeah, I think you're going to love it. It looks fantastic, and they did a great job on that building.
Yeah.
Hey, before we move on and get into what's going on with the Kraken, what's your favorite baseball stadium that you've been to? There's a lot that Like the Pittsburgh Pirates stadium on TV looks awesome. I would love to go there, or the Giants stadium. Both of those on TV look fantastic. I haven't been to them, but what would be yours?
Yeah, it's so hard to pick, and I just I'm speaking to you here from doing the ALCS and just having been at Fenway. And Fenway, I feel like this past these last couple of weeks, I have fallen back in love with Fenway. And it was probably my favorite when I was in college. And then as I traveled and went to other places, I think maybe some others surpassed it a bit. I've always loved Dodger Stadium. Pittsburgh is a phenomenal place to see a game. San Francisco as well. But I think Fenway, the history of it, and the way that they've done such a great job of modernizing it, while in some respects, actually, we can draw a parallel between Fenway and Climate Pledge, in that there was a foundation that was set by what was there for forever. But when you walk in the inside parts of Fenway now, it's like part museum, part ballpark. Parts of it are really old, where you can look at the mound and say, wow, Babe Ruth pitched here. And yet there are so many touches of it that are so modern. The monster seats, there's only one monster seat. And then there's only one green monster. And there's only one seating section like that. I still remember when they opened it when I was in college in Boston. And there were a lot of traditionalists that said, oh, no, you can't put seats on top of the monster. How dare you desecrate the monster with your commercialization of the seats. And then like a week later, the same people said, hey, can I get a ticket to sit up there? Because it looks kind of cool. And so like those like the duality of that nature of that ballpark has just always stood out to me. And you think about right field, the retired numbers, the history there. It's just and how engaged the crowd is. And that's what makes it. And that's where I think the building is great, but the crowd has to be a part of what makes the building great. And I think what I love about this is, and I get goosebumps just saying this, is like Seattle has a chance beginning Saturday to declare itself to be a great hockey city. And the canvas is blank. Whatever happened in the Metropolitans winning the Stanley Cup 100 years ago, the history is all cool. But you got to bring it as a hockey city every single game, the way that you hear Montreal crowd brings it, the way that a Vancouver crowd brings it, the way that Detroit, certainly we've lost our luster a bit as a hockey city in the last few years just because the team hasn't been so great, but what those crowds always were like at the Joe. It's up to the city. It's up to the fans, and I think it's so cool that you get a chance to literally open up a new book, page one, and start writing the history as of Saturday night. And I can't wait to see what Seattle does with that.
Man, you make me want to go get a ticket.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Gotta go.
I know.
It's gonna be incredible.
Hey, what do you make of the way they started the season and the road trip, returning home finally? But as far as their start,
yeah. So what happened was, first of all, I have to apologize to all the fans for mixing up my prediction. Here I said 3-1-1. It ends up being 1-3-1. It's my mistake. I'll take the blame for it.
It's your fault.
My bad there. My bad. I said that on the show. It was my mistake. A couple things, and I think Dave Hakstol said this, Mark Giordano said this, and it's a simple thing, but it's an important thing, is they need to practice. This team, you could tell, and I think Gio said it, and it was very well said, that this team has a lot of players that really want to do the right thing and care a lot. They're all trying to make a great impression. They're all trying to get to know their new teammates. There were different interruptions. We know even the day of the first game at Vegas, the players who were out for the COVID protocol, then they come on a private jet and show up. They care so much. They all want to be there. And I look at a team with some guys who I think have impressed really well. Getting back, Yanni Gord's been really important. Bastian brings a physical element. Tanev has come on and he's been able to score and he's been moving up the lineup. So there are individual soloists who are doing a great job. And now it's time to put the band together. And for that to happen, you have to have practice. And I think Dave Hakstol talked about it. Gio talked about it. And hopefully as they get a bit of a homestand going, they can really get those systems in harmony. We've even seen different changes at the power play. Guys who were going to be counted on, even Johansson, for example, was getting some power play minutes. Then he goes out. So I think that they need to have a bit more harmony day-to-day with just health and systems and practice time. I think one aspect, and this is maybe the one time in the call that I'll reference the Golden Knights from their inaugural season, because I don't think it's really a fair standard to really hold the Kraken to. But one of the things that happened with that team is they were a very healthy team. They had very few massive players out with significant injuries that missed a bunch of time. And already you've had a goaltender go out with an injury. Gord just came back. Yarncroke is just about to come back. I mean, they've had a lot of adversity early, and I think that is much more of a normal hockey season than what the Golden Knights had in their inaugural year.
You know, John, we're all learning the subtleties of the sport together here, and you know, we can just look at a score and go, wow, 6-1, tough night for the goalie. But, you know, in talking to some of my more well-educated hockey friends, they're saying, well, you know, some of these defenders are not helping Grubauer out very well at all in certain situations, and a lot of that's not on him. As you look at these games, how do you think he's played so far?
I think he's been fair. I think he's been okay. I would certainly not say that they're 1-3-1 because of Grubauer. That I think would not be correct. I think it's a team that, and I think Dave Hakstol has talked about this, they've given up a lot of chances in transition. And when you give up chances in transition, when the opposition is entering the zone with the puck, with odd man advantages, so a 3-on-2 or 2-on-1, with pace, if they're not being checked as they enter the neutral zone, they've got plenty of tempo as they're entering the zone with the puck, with options in front of them, it puts the goalie in a bad spot. And that was the case even the first game against Vegas, really the case a lot against Philly. I think that's probably the one outlier. And I was talking to one person in the organization today about this, about really, you look at the trip and four competitive games and one dud. The game against Philly was not good. It was not a good game. And I think they came back and showed a lot more fight against New Jersey. They were playing a fresh team where they had a back-to-back after traveling the night before. That's a tough assignment, even though it's on the East Coast and it's close travel, just to play two games in two nights in two different places. I think they played five games in five different states, different time zones. They've been through a lot in a very short amount of time. And I just think that for me, it's been a matter of the defense not being fully organized. And then they've still had to have some different fluidity. You know, Vince Dunn's a really key guy out of the lineup for a game, missed some time there. They just haven't gotten chemistry and rhythm yet among their three defensive pairings. That's going to come. I really believe it's going to come. And don't forget what we talked about last time around. I really think that as they try to find the D pairings, only having one righty is kind of an issue for this team, with Larson being the one righty, and they've had to have guys playing on their offside, which they can do, and Dunn has been able to do that. They've got some other guys that have been able to flip left to right, but it's not optimal. They don't really have a lot of balance, and I wonder if it's so early, it's not even really worth talking about who it could be and when, but I would venture to say that as you get through the trade deadline this year and then next year's free agency, that is something that Ron Francis is going to want to address. How do you look right to left with a defensive group?
John Paul, what about, you talked about, Bob and I were talking about the point spread that you get for being home, you know, and what the value of that is. Do we still have him? Still
yep,
there,
here,
John?
Yep,
okay,
yep.
There we go. So as far as hockey goes, what's the home ice advantage typically, and how, you know, how much of an advantage can it be here? You talked about Seattle and how dedicated these fans and how loud they can be. How much of an advantage can it be?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's hard to quantify it. Is it a goal a game? It can be when you bear that out in terms of how just the games end up unfolding. What I would say is always this. I always notice the home crowd most when either a team gets that first goal and then they're able to add on, or maybe they're down second period, here comes a power play, chance to tie, and the crowd really gets into it.
Yeah.
I think that they can – one of the things that I've always noticed, and I get goosebumps talking about it because it's one of the reasons why hockey is probably still the best sport live, even as I'm talking in the middle of covering playoff baseball games. A hockey game, when the crowd is into it, and one thing that I'll say to the Kraken fans listening that I think is always emblematic of a great hockey crowd is when the third or the fourth line has a really good shift. They didn't score, but they checked well. They started to, and you'll hear coaches talk about this, tilt the ice back in your favor. Maybe they made a big hit. Maybe they generated two chances. They negated a chance in the neutral zone. They got the puck back going the opposite way. And it's energy. And that's when that line goes off the ice and then the top line comes out. So maybe Tanev has a big hit, and all of a sudden here comes Yanni Gord's line with Schwartz over the boards with Eberle, and it's that top line out there. That's when the ovation kicks in. That's when you say, hey, good shift by the third line. Bastian had a good hit there. Yes, Geeky had a good play. And then you get momentum. That is how you know you're in a hockey building and not just an arena. That is where, when you're watching a game in Montreal, the fans will always be engaged. That's when there's an iffy call on icing, when they think that it shouldn't be icing or it should be, and the linesman does a different call and they get on the linesman, you know you're in a hockey building when that happens. And that to me is when a shot is blocked on a power play and the puck is cleared out of the zone by one of the penalty killers, that's when you get a huge ovation. That's when you're in a hockey building. It's those types of moments when the crowd is engaged. Yeah. It's not just cheering for the goals. It's got to be a continual volume where it does ebb and flow, but it's those key moments where the fans are urging on the team when they're expecting that push. That's when you really know you're in a hockey building, and I expect it to be that way starting Saturday.
Hey, John, what do you make of the increasing chippiness we've seen as these games have gone on? Is that just a matter of guys getting more comfortable with being a team and being out there together? We didn't even see a shove in the first game, and then sort of just picked up steam in every game after. And we've seen, you know, you go back to Jersey and Philadelphia, there were a lot of fights in those two games, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, there were.
What do you make of that?
There were. I think that, first of all, part of it is, to your point, I think getting used to it. And you even heard Dave Haxtell say this after the Jersey game, standing up for each other. Obviously, the fight that followed the Jack Hughes injury, which I'm concerned for Jack because he's great for the game. He's great for U.S. hockey. And I would have liked to have seen a different play there by Lauzon that's kind of my view of it. I think he probably could have made the check and made the play without kind of driving his shoulder into the boards quite in that fashion. But that, to me, is where the next time they play, there's going to be a subplot there. Is Jack back in the lineup by then? How does New Jersey respond? How do the Kraken respond to that? And that's where I think we talked about it a bit even last week, how we said the teams that become your rivals aren't always the obvious ones. But when you've got a player who's one of the marquee names in the league, who's now on injured reserve because of a hit that was made by Lauzon in that moment, that the next time they play, that's going to be an inescapable storyline that will be talked about. Is there another fight to be had? I would hope not. I hope that it was just dealt with that night and that's it. But hockey rituals are different. The culture of the sport is different. And that's also where you're going to see, I think, lineups get dressed for particular games based on how physical you're expecting the game's going to be. The Vegas game was very much an up and down kind of game. Vegas doesn't have Ryan Reeves anymore. So that immediate physical element isn't quite as strong. And you notice that game against Vegas was pretty free flowing. The game against Jersey was chippy. And I think it was partially maybe the lineup that Seattle dressed. I think you're going to see guys like Soucy is going to be a physical guy. Lauzon is a physical guy. Bastian can be physical, certainly. Tanev is a physical player. So depending on the word you sometimes hear in hockey is the thermostat, dialed up or back based on where you're at in the road trip, what you're feeling. Is there a fighter on the other team? Are you playing Washington? What's Wilson going to do? Those are all questions that you deal with during the course of a hockey season, and I think that the Kraken got a glimpse of that certainly during the course of the first road trip.
Hey, quickly, before we let you go, Jerry DePoto was on with our morning show, and they were just talking about, you know, the potential of bringing in free agents. There's some big names out there, certainly, that could address needs. But one thing he made clear is that J.P. Crawford will be the shortstop here. And a lot of the big names are shortstops, whether we're talking Carlos Correa or Corey Seager, Javi Baez, Trevor Story, Simeon, who's been playing second. But Correa made it clear, at least according to the broadcast the other day, he expects to play shortstop until he's just done playing, which we'll see if that happens. So if you're Jerry DePoto, who do you target? I would assume if JP's your guy, you're not going to target somebody like Correa who's saying, no, I'm a shortstop. So that tells me he's not going to be amenable to moving to second base. So what if you're in that spot and you're the Mariners, who do you target?
Correct. It has to be Semien. I think that's the name, because he was playing second with Toronto. You could play Semien at second with Seattle and move Toro to third. You could potentially have Toro play, or you could, I guess, theoretically have Toro at second and Semien at third. But I think Semien fits in the middle of the diamond. He's the guy. Now, could Trevor Story play third? Yes. I think Story's body type, his overall projection, leads me to believe that maybe he could play third. And he may also want to reestablish his numbers. That being said, T-Mobile's not necessarily the best place to go up and put up huge numbers, although certainly Seattle made the park play a little bit smaller this past year with the way the lineup works. So I think Story, possible. Semien, because he wants to play on the West Coast, even more possible. And I think Correa, based on what Jerry said, you'd have to cross him off the list. So Correa played third for the Puerto Rican national team at the World Baseball Classic, and I remember talking to him about that even during that competition 4 years ago. Okay, 4 years ago, and I said something about him playing well at third base. It was during a post game interview, and Carlos looked at me and said, "Don't forget, I'm still a shortstop. I'm just playing third base for the national team because we wanted to win the World Baseball Classic." So it was because Javi Baez was there, and it was an amazing team. Lindor was there. That was their infield. Baez at second, Lindor at short, Correa at third. It was incredible. Mm. But Carlos said it clearly. I remember distinctly, he looked me in the eyes and said, "I am a shortstop." So he is going to be a shortstop. And I think in fairness, and it's a good call. JP played well for this team. But I think it does mean they're going to have to target either Semien or Story. And you know what? I think they have a legit chance to land one of the two of them, especially Semien, because I really think as a native of the Bay Area, he wants to play on the West Coast.
Great stuff, John. We always look forward to the conversation, and we appreciate it. So have fun out there watching some baseball, and we'll talk again next week.
I can't wait. Saturday night, we could have a Game 7 in the ALCS and the inaugural home game for the Kraken. Back-to-back, my friends.
How about
it's going to be incredible sports. And just everybody, enjoy this weekend. You only get one chance to open up the new building once. So let's make it a great one, guys. I wish I could be there myself. It's going to be a lot of fun.
We appreciate you, John.
Thanks, guys.
Man.
All the best. You bet. Thank you.
There you go. Our weekly visit with NHL insider John Morosi is presented by Stanford's Restaurant. Did you hear the little clap?
Yeah, I know. If he doesn't get you fired up.
Did you hear the clap? He's like in a bathroom in the hotel room or something, I think.
See, I loved going to a concert with you because, like I said, you're watching the concert like I would watch a football game.
Yeah, analyzing.
We need to get Lefko and Morosi.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Out there watching hockey.
A couple of hockey dimwits like us could have two experts sitting there. That'd be good for
especially
us.
Especially on his birthday. Birthday boy.
Yeah, birthday on Saturday?
Saturday, yeah.
Didn't even know that.
On Saturday.
Yeah. Saturday. And you're gonna celebrate it by going to the Kraken game?
Yeah. Okay. Can't think of a better way to do it, right?
No.
You only open a building once, as I just heard.
That's what I just heard.
Yeah.
Don't waste it. Don't waste the opportunity.
Just once. All right. Thanks to John Morosi. Coming up, the quarterbacks will be the most important guys on the field Monday night. So we'll dive into the key matchups coming up next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Hey, Bob, during that John Paul Morosi interview, there were a couple of really good questions asked.
A bunch of mediocre to poor questions, apparently, yeah.
Somebody mopped the
you
floor.
You won. 2-0. I was shut out. Shut out on the great. That's a great question.
That's something I can really lean my hat on.
You should lean your hat on
that. Look how quick Dave jumped in on that, too.
I want to get to it before Bob brought us back to the show.
Brought us back to reality.
Yeah.
You know, for the things that matter. Like Lefko's birthday. You know, for you people, mean texts, you know, maybe you take it easy on him this week in honor of his birthday. How about that?
I think you go extra mean.
Do you go extra mean for his birthday?
It's going to be something about pretty soon you'll be as old as Wyman or... Jeez,
that's more of a shot at you.
Yeah, those are shots at you.
What would you prefer? They go after you in honor of your birthday, or they just, hey, you know what, maybe take it easy on me this week?
I don't think you can ask for a preference for mean texts. They just come.
I think they'll go opposite
if they happen,
whatever you
they
ask
happen.
For.
There's no requests.
There's no requests.
You can't request. All
except
right.
when you asked them to step it up that one day.
They did. They complied. That was
they
good.
Did. They did, yeah.
Yeah.
They got better.
Good. Yeah, so we'll have birthday donuts in honor of Lefko tomorrow. So that'll be good. the quarterbacks, as we were talking about going to the break, the most important guys on the field any night you got two teams. That's typically how it goes. In terms of the challenge, it's we talked about this to open the show, in that the Saints, the passing game is an issue on both sides of the ball. They don't pass it well, they don't defend it well. But they run really well, and they defend the run really well. And they don't allow very many points in their top 10 in scoring points. So it's a very weird dynamic with that team. And Pete Carroll, speaking with the media this morning, talked about the quarterback in how they're using him out there.
Well, he's, you know, the QB rating we got is 108, you know, and in compliment to the running game that they're really featuring. He's playing really well. He's making some huge plays, and they're using his ability to get the ball down the field really well, and complement with the run game, and he's fitting in well. You know, it's not exactly the same as when it was with Drew, but Sean is such a good ball coach that he figures it out, how to, you know, make the guys come to life and get the most out of them. So that's what it looks like is happening.
See, and I heard that, and I took that more of a compliment on Sean Payton, saying he understands who he's dealing with in Jameis Winston. He understands what he does well, and more importantly, what he doesn't do well, and is really limiting the opportunities for Jameis to be in a position to not do those things well, the way they did in Tampa.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I feel like if they were in Tampa, the Hail Mary that he threw at the end of the half against the Washington football team. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think he can do a ton of good, Sean Payton, that is, for Jameis Winston. And, you know, what Pete's talking about there, too. I mean, you have Marquez Callaway has a 58-yard catch. Deontay Harris, a 72-yard catch. The Hail Mary was 50. You see a lot of long plays. They're taking shots downfield. But the guy, to me, it's Kamara. He's the guy. I mean, he's also, like last week, Najee Harris. I think, was he the most targeted player, I think, last week? Yeah, he was first or second. Yeah, it was first or second, because Kamara's the most targeted.
Right.
You know, and so he doesn't have the most catches. But, he's got 50. Well, actually, he does have the most catches. He doesn't have the most yards. It's just a lower average. But, yeah, he's got 15 catches for 22 yards. Long story short, he's good for 100 yards a game. I mean, it's 22 and 73 and change as far as 73 on the ground, 22 receiving. So that's a big deal. I mean, that's a great little safety valve and check down for Jameis Winston.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the box score from last week. Apparently it was Deontay Johnson was the most targeted for the Steelers in that game.
Oh, yeah.
He had 13 targets. Harris had 7.
Yeah. But I think going into that game, I think Najee Harris was up there. And, you know, that's just a little nice little check down, nice to have. But Kamara's like the best in the business.
Which side of the ball are you more concerned with when it comes to the Saints? Are you more worried about their defense, or does their offense worry you more?
That's a great question, Bob.
Put it up on the board.
It's really a good question, because I'm still going to go with the defense. I mean, our defense.
So their
bigger
offense.
Concern.
Okay. So yeah. So you're saying their offense, but it's more about our defense.
That's exactly right. Okay. Is everybody following this, by the way?
Yeah, I think I understand now.
What am I most worried about? I'm still worried about the Seahawks defense, because it got a little bit better last week. You know, the other thing is, I'm going to have to say right now, who's their best player on defense? It's Darrell Taylor. Yeah.
Or Diggs.
Yeah, I love Diggs. I mean, he's got 2 takeaways, and, you know, he hasn't made a ton of tackles. Like last year, I saw him make this open field tackle. It was just ridiculous.
The Matrix one.
Yeah. And, you know, you saw plays like that. And I just don't think he doesn't get involved as much. You know, he's the guy that's the last line of defense. So it's not like he's going to be up on the line of scrimmage making tackles or anything. But Darrell Taylor is your best player on defense right now. And kind of worry about him a little bit. Like we were saying earlier, I mean, Pete, I think that we looked at the injury report. Was he a full go? I think he was.
Taylor today? Or was he limited?
No, he was limited. He was limited, which means he probably went through some drills, you know, limbered up, all that stuff, and then stayed out of the team stuff.
No collision stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't want to be anywhere near that. But and that's your best player. So it'll be interesting. You know, he gets an extra day, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, for a guy that was hauled off in an ambulance. I mean, that's kind of worrisome. But, yeah, the defense still, I mean, I thought it was better because they only gave up 23 points. But, you know, there's still a couple of times where I feel like in the run game they're not being physical enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's – Kamara is a big, strong dude. I remember the touchdown he scored last time that they were here, and he must have broke four tackles. You know, so that's still going to be my concern. Even in, isn't that sad? Because you have, you know, three really good players on defense that are very highly paid, the highest paid safety, the highest paid linebacker, and you're worrying about the defense when you have a backup quarterback who's replacing.
And a backup running back, too.
Yeah, and like what, third string in Collins is even banged up. So, I mean, yeah. Even the third stringer. Of course, you know, I'm not
Lewis
counting.
Is banged up.
Yeah, Lewis, he left that game. So
maybe we should be more concerned about the offense.
Starting to talk me
this.
Into offense, Bob. Yeah,
yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that as far as the defense goes or the offense goes.
What about you though? What's your concern?
I'm more concerned about the Saints' defense and more specifically their ability to stop the run.
Yeah,
that's. I guess we'll find out. We had. I keep forgetting his name. The guy
Mark Triplett.
Yes. Yeah. Tell it when we asked. Hey, are these numbers for real? You know, because according to the stats, they're number two in the league in stopping the run.
Right.
So, is that real? Is that benefit of their opponents? That's real. We were all excited about the running game last week, and hey, the line mm-hmm. got it together. And man, Collins looked great, and that's going to take pressure off Geno. Now you go up against what appears to be a very stout run defense. So that I'm thinking, okay, so that puts everything on the arm of Geno. I don't know if I love that. That doesn't make me feel super comfortable other than the fact that the one area of the Saints defense that isn't good, according to the stats, is their pass defense. So maybe it works this week. We'll see. But as far as the offense goes, Rashad Penny should make his return against the Saints. But what can we realistically expect out of him? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
So Rashad Penny is a big topic around the Seahawks team. We talked about him earlier in the show for those of you just joining us. He's expected, I think Pete said, what, he's raring to go? Raring to go. Fired up. Had a great week. Couple of great weeks. So
he's raring to go, Bob.
Yeah, he's fired up. He's ready to do some business out there on the field, unlike any other time in his career, we're hoping. But there's a lot of people that keep texting in, oh, he won't make it through the game. He's going to get hurt, the most recent one. Penny won't make it a full four quarters before he's injured. It's just it's not even lack of faith in his ability. It's just his ability to stay healthy. You know, and it's not helped when he was injured all of preseason. Then when he finally gets healthy, gets into a game, what, he had two carries or three carries? I can't remember. Two or three, and then he's injured again.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't help.
The Indy game. Was it his calf? I think it was.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
This is the weird thing, though. You know, we found this out today on the huddle that we talked to John Boyle, that he had one of the better medical grades for a running back that in that draft. Like, and I went back and looked, and before I even heard that, I was like, hey, I wonder how many he missed, you know? So you go back and look, and Nick Chubb, I think, missed, like, from what I can tell, probably seven or eight games.
In his college career.
In his whole college career.
Right.
Yeah.
And most of them in one season, right?
Yeah, it was one, I think it was sophomore year, he played in six games, and I don't know what they played, 13, something like that.
He still had, like, 700 and some yards in those six games.
Yeah, and he averaged, like, 7 yards.
I think it was eight. You said it was, like, a little over eight,
I
think.
Oh, my God. So anyway, yeah, Nick Chubb is always going to be sort of attached to Penny, but you know he might have had a lesser medical grade.
Yeah.
But you know if you look at, and I'd forgotten about Moyer brought it up that Rashad Penny also had two punts that he returned. One was for a touchdown.
Right.
So they put him out there twice his senior year. Then he had another 7 kickoff returns for touchdowns. So, I mean, the guy had like 50-some touchdowns. He looked really good. That's just, you know, and as much as we say, oh, they blew it with Chubb, but probably at the time, if you're looking at it, there's not much to dislike about Rashad Penny. But then he gets in the NFL. Then he gets hurt. I think the first thing was his finger. Then he had a very serious problem with his knee.
Knee, yep.
ACL, I believe.
Yep.
So, yeah, and then, you know, he comes back from that, and then it's just been kind of hit or miss. So, I don't know, man. I don't know if there's – I just think it's very unlikely that he has any kind of a season that makes them want to sign him back here.
I think it would be virtually impossible. I think it would have to be just the perfect storm, like somehow – and this is obviously hypothetical and not anything you want to see, but somehow the neck thing with Carson proves to be more serious and maybe his career's in doubt or – They don't want to mess with it. They don't trust that he'll be able to go again. And Penny, in return, you know, with Carson out, goes nuts every game, the next 11 games. I mean, in my opinion, it would have to be something that extreme. Carson can't go, done for the year. Penny steps in, and in 11 games in a row, he's just a maniac. Even then, I think they'd have apprehensions about, man, he's been much more fragile than durable. He's been much less productive than productive. If you're adding up, you know, what weighs more here, these 11 games or the previous three seasons, you know, so I really think it's a virtual impossibility that he could do anything that would get them excited enough to say, we're going to commit to this guy long term. Maybe they would offer him, hey, we'll sign you a 1-year deal, a prove it deal. And maybe he doesn't even get that out there. Maybe at best case would be something like that.
Well, and I'd also make the case that if Alex Collins is healthy, he's going to have a hard time proving enough to get more carries.
Yep.
Yeah, because, you know, I was saying this during the week. Alex Collins, and, you know, I was hesitant to say it after the San Francisco game just because, you know, it was just kind of one time. He ran the really good trap play up the middle, and I was saying, yeah, he's seeing the defense. He's making great cuts. But after last week, I think he's running as well as any – he's making decisions, I'll put it that way, as good a decisions as any running back in the league right now. So how does Penny even get more carries than him? I mean –
No, it's a fair point. I was in that equation, I was discounting Collins' presence. It was more about the starter and what
yeah.
– it would have to be something just so extreme to where he did get those opportunities. And I just don't – I don't see it happening. I just don't think – I think at this point – he should. If I were his agent, I'd say you need to approach this as an audition for your next team. There's the likelihood of you coming back to Seattle are slim and none. So treat this as, hey, I'm putting 11 games on tape. However many carries I get, whether I get 20 or I get 4 or 2, whatever it is, I'm gonna do everything within my power to make them the best carries I've ever had. Because I think he's playing for his next team. This is what he's doing. It's an audition tape.
Yeah. 253 says, why would they re-sign Penny? Okay, that's the question we're asking right now, you know. And I guess there's a way. I mean, could he make us forget? You can't really see that now. But if he puts together some of his best games that he's had, you know, and I don't want to say he has to do it every week, but at least every other week, and you know, then maybe there's a way that and also I think it would have to come along with him signing a hometown discount.
Yeah, and I think it would be a 1-year prove-it deal, no matter what he does. I just don't think there's enough. There are not enough games and opportunities in front of him with the Seahawks to get to a point where they would even drift off their position at all. I think.
Well, and look at you look at like right now the deal that Carson signed. I mean, that was not this big, huge, punitive thing for the Seahawks. Look at what Christian McCaffrey did. You know, with Carolina,
I think he's been healthy
like for 4 games, $16 million a year.
That's brutal.
That's why you don't do that.
Yeah. All right. Coming up, we'll talk some more football with the professor. John Clayton will join us next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.